Support comes from Hampton Roads Community Foundation, partnering with donors from all walks of life to improve Southeastern Virginia through grants, scholarships, and leadership initiatives. Learn more at HamptonRoadsCF.org.
Hello, everyone. I'm Barbara Ham Lee. Throughout history, African Americans have made inroads in various fields, medicine, science, and music, just to name a few, and the journeys of these trailblazers inspiring others along the way. What was it that got them to climb to such heights and continues to inspire others today? Coming up on this edition of Another View, we talk to civil rights photographer Herb Randall, iconic actress, model, and broadcaster Jane Kennedy, and world-renowned gospel violinist Eric Taylor. We'll hear their stories when Another View returns, right after this news from NPR and WHRO News.
Discussing today's topics from an African-American perspective, this is Another View.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Another View. I'm Barbara Ham Lee. Before we delve into today's discussion, I want to remind you to register to be a part of our Another View audience next Thursday for our Juneteenth broadcast. Now, it all takes place right here at WHRO Public Media on June 18th. I'll be joined by historian Yola Dance and give you a preview of the new Juneteenth song. Producer Lisa Godley will be outside with the food truck vendors and interviews galore. Guess what? You may even hear from a celebrity or two. Plus, our Miss Martha Reeds, the manager of early childhood learning here at WHRO, will be here with activities for the children so you can bring the whole family and come join us. You don't want to miss this. Make sure you register at whro.org/events to secure your spot. Often we look to our heroes with admiration, but usually we can only scratch the surface about the path they took to get there. On this edition of Another View, we'll talk with three trailblazers: civil rights photographer Herb Randall, iconic actress, model, and broadcaster Jane Kennedy, and world-renowned gospel violinist Eric Taylor. Each one following a dream that to this day has impacted not only their lives, but the lives of so many others. We begin the hour with producer Lisa Godley's conversation with a woman who since the 70s has broken one glass ceiling after another. Actress, model, spokeswoman, and sports broadcaster, the legendary Jane Kennedy.
Jane Kennedy Overton is quick to point out that her fame came fast, but I was curious about her influences.
You've always been a role model for me, but who inspired you?
Well, I'd have to say that in my early childhood, it would definitely be my mom and dad. They were the focus of the entire family, not just, you know, my immediate family, but, you know, on holidays, everybody came to our house. So it was that kind of family. My mom and dad were wonderful. And they did. They inspired me. They came from humble beginnings. And they truly inspired me that I could do anything. And that's what they kept telling me. You know, they never let me think that it was a challenge in life. They always let me know the reality of life. Of course, growing up in the 60s, you learn that real fast. I was in my teens in the 60s. So, you know, with all, everything that was going on in this country, with, you know, burn your draft card, burn your bra, presidents being assassinated, Martin Luther King's assassination. So many things that went through the 70s that changed the shape of America, and it also changed me.
Standing 5'10" tall, Jane Kennedy was a consummate beauty. Her looks set the bar, shattering her first glass ceiling at 19, when she became the first Black woman to win the title of Miss Ohio USA in 1970.
What would you consider your first public appearance?
Ooh, No one has ever asked me that before. My first public appearance, I would have to say eighth grade. I was selected to be part of a debate panel, and the entire city was invited. So, I mean, Wycliffe is very small, but to me, it was a big deal.
Was there anyone that said, you're adorable, you really should go on the pageant circuit, or was that just something within yourself that said, I want to do this? How'd you end up competing in pageants?
Well, we ended up, there's five girls in my family, and we would all watch the pageants, all of them, you know, whenever they came on television. And so it was a big deal, you know, but never thinking that I would do that one day. I did think, you know, they got scholarships, you know, they can go to college. So that was always in the back of my mind, but it wasn't that, you know, I was going to be in one one day. And then in my senior year in high school, my mom sent my photo and she saw in the newspaper that they were looking for participants, and she sent my picture in. And next thing I know, I got a call from the Cleveland headquarters saying that, you know, they wanted me to compete in the Miss Cleveland pageant. And there I was, you know, and so I did a smaller pageant that I found just to feel what it was like. And it was a pageant that was, I think it was from the Call and Post, which was the Black local newspaper in Cleveland. And so I won that pageant and I said, okay, so I'm learning how to do this, you know. And then when I got to the time where we did the Miss Ohio pageant, I was just in awe of all the other ladies that were there. And I didn't even hear them when they called my name that I had won because I had picked the winner. And she came in first place, and I'm looking around all the other girls. Who's going to beat her, you know? And then my sister said, Jane, you won. You won.
Wow. So what was it like moving on from Miss Ohio?
Moving on? It was my senior year. And I think the worst part of it or the best part of it depends on how you look at it. The night of the pageant in Miami was the same night as my senior prom. And I had been class president and vice president, and I had been an advocate for everything in high school. I had so many challenges and things that I participated in. And, you know, I never thought that I was going to be not able to be at my senior prom. But they said that the pageant in Miami was going to be the same night of my prom. So the directors at the prom committee decided that they would put televisions in the prom, and they were able to watch the pageant. So I'm in Miami, and the first day, and I go up to the mic, and I say, I'm Jane Harrison from Wycliffe, Ohio. And they quickly inform me that I can't say Wycliffe because nobody knows where Wycliffe is. So they said I had to say Cleveland.
Wow.
So here I am developing the idea that I have power. You know, I have power. I can do this. So the night of the live broadcast, I walked up to the mic. And even though I'd been saying Cleveland all week, I said, hi, I'm Jane Harrison from Wycliffe, Ohio. It's live, right? What are they going to do? And the prom, they went crazy. They were watching it, and they just went crazy. They erupted, Wycliffe, Ohio, Wycliffe, Ohio. And then when I got home, they had put a banner up in the city, welcome to the home of Miss Ohio.
Oh, so
however,
nice.
It was torn down three times because it was still an era where the white people were not accepting black people.
Wow.
One year after graduating high school, Jane married actor Leon Isaac Kennedy. Throughout the 70s, Jane had guest roles on some of the most popular television shows, The $6 Million Man, Sanford and Son, Starsky and Hutch. Then, in 1978, she smashed yet another glass ceiling when she became the first black woman to hold the position of sportscaster on the NFL Today, proving that a black woman could not just survive, but excel in white male spaces.
Jane, how about the New York Marathon? How'd that turn out?
Well, Brent, more than 2 million people lined the streets earlier today to watch the New York Marathon. And one of those who was waiting at the finish line was Jack Whitaker. So now let's go to a report from Jack Whitaker.
As the first black woman to join the NFL Today team, I'd like for you, if you could, share a high and a low, because I know you probably went through a lot, and I know you had some great moments, but I'm sure you went through a lot.
First of all, it was just really hard to get the job because they kept saying they didn't want someone like me, and that someone like me, it was they didn't want someone Black. The audition, the final audition, after interviewing so many people, they called it the largest talent hunt since Scarlett O'Hara from Gone with the Wind. And so we end up in New York with 17 people. 16 were all blonde. So it was very clear that they did not want a Black woman. And I did the interview, and I think there were three women after me. And when I finished my interview, Brent Musburger got up and he said, "It's Jane or nobody." And he walked out of the studio and he didn't even finish interviewing the other women. So it was going to be a challenge because in the Southern affiliates of CBS, they knew that that was going to be a problem with them because that would mean that you have two Blacks on the show and one white. And that was going to be me, Irv Cross, and then Brent Musburger. And so they had to send my audition tape to the Southern affiliates. How can we fix this? And they came up with the idea. Jimmy the Greek was already on the show doing statistics, and they decided to put him on the main desk. And that would be two Blacks and two whites. And that's how I got my job. For just 6 weeks, I still had to prove myself again. And the second week, they decided that they were having problems on their other sports show, Sports Spectacular. And it was one of the most highest rated shows there was. And they did not have the rights to get the Muhammad Ali interview in New Orleans with Leon Spinks that night. And they were having a dizzy. Man, they were, I heard the screaming and yelling. They said, "We can't be the only network not getting this interview." I said, "I can get you the interview." And they said, "Who are you?" I said, "I'm the woman who can get you the interview." And I said, "You put me on a jet. I will go down and I will have the interview for you tomorrow." And I don't know why they believed me, but they did. They sent me. I called my friend, Muhammad Ali. They didn't know he was my friend. And I said, "I need to get this interview." And he did it for me that night. And they aired it on Sports Spec the next day and on my show on the NFL Today on Sunday. And on Monday, I got a call that my contract for the year had been picked up. So you have to advocate for yourself whenever you can.
Wow. Did you ever, I'm sure you have, had a conversation with Brent about when he said, "It's Jane or nobody"? Did you all talk about that?
I have, many, many years later, maybe 30 years later. And it was I hadn't seen him in all that time. And we were on air doing his show in Las Vegas. And I said, "Do you remember?" And he said, "I absolutely remember." He said, "Because you were the best." And he said, "And you brought out from the athletes something that they maybe other people couldn't have had." He said, "They all trusted you and they all believed in you." And he said, "And you gave them that human compound." Most of the time, you know, they're seen as, you know, this an athlete with a number on their back. And especially the recognition of the Black athlete during that time and the strength that they had in going forward. That was important, and I was able to bring that out.
She began hosting Greatest Sports Legends in 1982, the same year she won an Emmy for hosting the Rose Bowl. Jane Kennedy would go on to adorn the covers of one major magazine after another, and as an actress, appear in numerous movies. She served as a spokeswoman for several major brands, including 6 years with Coca-Cola. In 1985, 3 years after her divorce from Leon Isaac Kennedy, she would marry actor Bill Overton. The couple would happily raise a family and work on projects together. Then one day, it all came to a screeching halt, which Jane talks about in her book, Plain Jane.
In your book, you candidly share a lot of things. And I'm almost hesitant to bring this up, but I have to ask because you talk about it in the book. There was a tape that so many of us thought your ex-husband had leaked, and now they're saying it was someone else. And when all that happened in your life, what did you think it was doing to your career?
It destroyed my career. It destroyed everything. When it came out, my husband Bill and I were producing a musical stage play called The Journey of the African American. and it had been received so well. It was supposed to run 6 weeks and ended up running for 10 months. And then we got booked to be on the road. We were in Atlanta, and when I found out that the rest of all the other theaters had canceled our contract, and all of us had to go back home to Los Angeles with no jobs. But they canceled it because they heard about the tape. I did come to find out. You know, it's not that it was just someone, someone found out, but, you know, like it was Leon's cousin who had broken into his home, and we had totally forgotten. I had totally forgotten it existed because it was done in 1975. And this was already 1991. And I had a family. I had Cheyenne, Bill's daughter from his first marriage, and my two daughters. So this was a long time. People thought that, you know, Leon did it with revenge in mind. But he didn't. He didn't, because that would have happened in 1981 when we divorced. But this is now 10 years later. And this tape comes out, and it was my cousin called me, and she said, Jane, he died. And on his deathbed, he confessed to me that it was him who released the tape because he needed to buy drugs because he was an addict.
Wow.
Family member.
Wow.
Someone who had had in my home for many times, who I had fed, who I had helped when he was, didn't have money, didn't have anything to hold on to, and I had helped him. And then this is what he did.
Wow, that had to break your heart.
And more.
Wow.
Broke my heart and more. It ruined my career. It ruined my self-esteem. It was a challenge for me to go anywhere. It was a difficult period in my life, and I fought a lot with myself to whether I included it in the book. But I knew that if I did not include it and people knew about it, they would not believe the other truth that I write about in the book. And if I'm going to show people who I am and not who the media thinks I am, then I need to be honest and tell my story. And I also did not want people to continue blaming Leon, because he did not.
Got it. Okay. Thank you so much for sharing that. What's next? Is there a book two? Are you working on a film? What's happening?
Well, I am in the process of creating a biodoc or a documentary and of the book. And we will see how that goes. But I also have a fragrance that I've developed called Jane Kennedy Sun and Jane Kennedy Moon, which I launched at the same day that the book launched. And those fragrances can be bought on my website, janekennedy.com. But they were developed with the idea of who am I, you know, which is what I've been doing for the last 20 years is who am I? You know, because my career went so fast. I started working only 2 weeks into Hollywood, and my career, you know, yes, there were downtimes, but for the most part, it just sped by so quickly. And I was able to achieve such success that, and you don't have social media, you don't have, you know, podcasts telling you, you know, what people think about you. You're just, and you know, it was Jet Magazine. That was the only information that the African-American public had. And so you're just working. You don't really realize in those moments the impact that you're making. It's only an aftersight when I see, you know, and I'm getting the awards for this, and I'm talking to people like you, people that I just meet in the grocery store, and a lady stopped me. She says, oh my God, Jane, it was the year 2000. She said, have you seen Ebony? And I said, no. She says, you've got to buy it. It's at the front of the market stand. Please go get it. Pick it up now. And I had my daughters with me who are still in school. And so we go to pick it up, and it was celebrating all the famous people of the past century. And they had me in the book.
Oh, nice. As well you should have been. Absolutely.
My daughters and I are going down the street, and the radio is on. Now we're going home after I picked them up from school. And all of a sudden, I hear on the radio, oh, man, she's so ill. Man, she's word to my mother, man. She was fine, just like Jane Kennedy.
Ah.
It was most deaf. And he was talking about the newest record that had come out. And, oh, my God, my girls, they started screaming, Mom, why did he say your name on the radio? Because they didn't know me as the TV personality. They knew me as mom, soccer mom. And, it was just so much fun when they started learning who I was. And I really enjoy that. I also like to share, one of the reasons that I'm coming to Norfolk is working with music and medicine. Because, this is not something that's new to me. And my mom has dementia. And so I know how important it is to have, people communicate with you and people that care for you. And so this is really an important thing. And I just wanted to be able to be there to support that. I also worked with Resurrecting Lives Foundation and some of the trauma that some of the soldiers came back from Vietnam and some of the soldiers that are still coming home. And, just to have someone care for you, loneliness is people think it's simple, but it can be a death tool to be lonely so much that you have nowhere to turn. So when you have somebody that can just reach out and just say, hey, would you like to sing today? Hey, do you want to hear my story today? Those little things in life for these people, it's life-changing. It truly is. And so when they said that they wanted me to come, it was an honor for me to do that. And so I'm very much looking forward to being there.
Hampton Roads is looking forward to having you here. Absolutely.
Well, thank you. You guys got me when they wrapped that bus.
I was just looking at that picture. It's a beautiful picture.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
Absolutely. Well, you enjoy the rest of your day. And again, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was a joy speaking with you.
Absolutely. My joy. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Jane will be in Norfolk this Sunday on June 14th for Medicine and Music's inaugural First Circle of Care Honors. Things get underway at 2 p.m. in the Hilton Hotel's Granby Ballroom. For more information, you can go to medicineandmusic.org.
You're listening to a pre-recorded episode of Another View. Please hold your calls and enjoy the show.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with trailblazers who've made their mark around the world and inspired many along the way. We started the hour with actress, model, and broadcaster Jane Kennedy, and now you're about to hear from civil rights photographer Herb Randall.
At 89 years old, Herb Randall has a lot he can reflect on. He was a freelance photographer for the United Press International and the Associated Press. But it was what he encountered in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, back in the summer of 1964, that continues to stir memories and emotions for Herb.
For those who don't know you, I want you to share how you ended up in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Please share who Herb Randall was before he ventured down south and how he got there in the first place.
So there was a friend who worked at the New York City SNCC office, SNCC meaning Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She was an office manager, Julie Prettyman. And so she was a friend of the family's, and she said, Herb, you have a fellowship, and maybe you would like to go down this summer and take some photographs. And I said, well, where's the program at? And she said, hesitantly, Mississippi. And I said directly, there's no way in hell I'm going to Mississippi. I hadn't been to any part of the South prior to that time. I was 28, and I avoided the South.
So what did your family say when you finally decided you were going down to Hattiesburg, Mississippi? What did your family say about that?
Well, my family... my family... they thought I was strange anyhow, but well, they didn't want me to go. They said, you going to Mississippi? What is wrong with you? No, they were not happy with that. And you know, I went anyhow. Yeah.
You believe in freedom. Cannot rest until it comes. We'll believe in
pardon the hesitation, but it kind of brings me back to a scary time. Most of the people at the training session went to Mississippi by bus, and for some reason, I was asked to go by car. So the car that I went into was a small foreign car, which was not the best choice to go to Mississippi. So there were other people who I went with. I think there were like four white females and the guy who owned the car. So it's me, him, and everybody's white except me. And so that wasn't the best way to go to Mississippi. So I was kind of smuggled in. I was on the floor of a foreign car. I'm not laughing because this is humorous. I can afford to laugh now. Why the hell not? So I was on the floor of a car when we got into the southern states, because the southern states police officers were looking for us too. And so I was kind of smuggled into Mississippi. Yeah. And the first full day that I was in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, that night, the car that I came down in was shot into. So I didn't take it personally, you know, but I just, you know, that's why I came down there, to be whatever help I could be. Well, that's not the main reason. The main reason was to photograph. But when other things needed to be done, you do them. Yeah, you want to help. You want to do it.
And struggling myself, don't need a whole lot. I've come to realize that teaching others to stand up and fight is the only way my struggle survives.
One of Herb's most famous photographs was taken that summer and published over and over and over again. It was a photo of Rabbi Arthur Lilienfeld, who was bloody and suffering from a concussion after being hit with a tire iron while trying to register people to vote.
You didn't want to document the blood and gore of the movement.
No, I didn't want it, nor was I going to do it.
When he asked you to take a picture and his blood's running from his forehead and it's onto his clothing, he asked you to take that picture. What was your initial reaction before you did?
Well, the thing is that the night before this happened, we had a long conversation. And so I said, or he said, or we said, that we were supposed to meet at a specific time because he was going out to do a voter registration. And so we picked a specific time. So the next day, I got there always before that time. But for some reason or other, he had gone out with some other workers to do, God, excuse me, this brings back Anyhow, he had left with some other workers, and so someone said, "Well, I'll take you over to that area." And so I said, "I'd appreciate it." And so we went over to that area. When we got to the area, I knew something had happened. There was a crowd up on the railroad tracks there. So I found out that he and another worker were beaten, and I think there may have been two females with them, but they weren't touched. I don't think. So he walked down from where he was beaten, and he was bleeding, and so he was really bleeding badly, and we set him down, and so I didn't know what to do first, to stop the bleeding or to take the picture. I know I had to take the picture, but the man is bleeding, so we have to, try to, whatever. Anyhow, so the rabbi said at one point, because I was just standing there, he said, "Photographer, take the picture." And that was how it got taken.
Okay. Did he share at all how he was attacked or anything?
He was in no condition to share how he was attacked. He was in shock, or some kind of shock or something. But the civil rights people were walking along the railroad station tracks, and this man came up with a I think it was a tire iron, pardon me, a tire iron or something, and called him a lot, called that group a lot of things, and started beating. And he hit the rabbi, and then he hit, one of the other workers were hit. He didn't touch the females.
Herb Randall's works have been in exhibitions at the Brooklyn Museum, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art, to name a few. His book, Faces of Freedom Summer, was published in 2001.
I'm going to fast forward a little bit to the book. On page 137, there's a photo of three teens at Vernon Donner's Fish Fry. And when I first looked at Vernon Donner, I thought he was white, but I've since learned that his skin was light enough that he could have passed for white, but he chose not to. And he worked diligently with the civil rights movement, including being president of Forest County chapter of the NAACP. Did you have an opportunity to sit down and talk with him when you weren't photographing him? And I'm curious as to if he ever expressed concerns about his own safety during that time.
That sound wasn't a humorous response. I'm sorry. Please, I'm sorry. I interrupted you. He was very much aware. He was very much aware of what the situation was and is. And, oh, my God, I didn't know how the man stayed alive in the state of Mississippi at the time, as long as he did, with the attitude that he had.
Mr. Donner was killed by the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan a couple of years after that fish fry photo, correct?
I think it was 4 years, but I'm not sure. I think it was two or four years. I get his killings but you're right. Yes.
Okay. And how long were you down there in Hattiesburg, Mississippi?
I was in Hattiesburg approximately 2 months, from June until August or something like that.
You have photographed some famous names like Fannie Lou Hamer. Can you share a little bit about that or any other famous people you photographed?
Well, Mrs. Hamer, I have to call her Mrs. Hamer because that's a southern thing that they would appreciate, and I appreciated that lady.
Fannie Lou Hamer is often defined as a symbol of the Mississippi movement. She was a sharecropper evicted from her plantation. News outlets reported that then-President Lyndon B. Johnson was so concerned about the impact of her televised testimony to a credentials committee that he held a news conference at the same time to interrupt the coverage. But that backfired because news outlets played her testimony over and over again for several days, giving the activist and organizer from Mississippi a national platform.
Mr. Chairman, and to the Credentials Committee, it was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the county courthouse in Indianola to try to register to become first-class citizens. We was met in Indianola by policemen. I was carried to the county jail and put in the booking room. They left some of the people in the booking room and began to place us in cells.
Oh, God. She, I can't tell you how much I thought of that lady or that person. Just to spend a little bit of time with her, you know, she was quite a individual.
Many of the photos Herb captured that summer were of children. He remembers one day specifically.
This was a summer, and they were out of their regular school, which taught them nothing about black history. The people who were running the educational thing, they had planned for 50 pupils, and so the registration was the next day or whenever it was. 600 children, you know, were out there waiting to sign up for classes.
I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom.
I asked her what was the driving force behind his photography.
Mainly, it was for me, and to express things that I hoped maybe people would care about.
Once he returned to New York, Herb Randall would utilize his talents teaching young people the art of photography for 10 years before going on to work as a photographic consultant for the National Media Center. In 1981, Herb, who is both Black and Native American, moved to the Shinnecock Indian Reservation in Southampton, New York, and in 1999, he would donate 1,800 negatives to the University of Southern Mississippi Archives in Hattiesburg. Herb's works are currently being showcased in a book on indigenous photographers titled In Light and Shadow. Jennifer Fish wrote Herb's story in the book.
Well, we're so honored to have Herb with us and to be featured in this book because he's one of 80 photographers, and he has a unique position in the book because he sits with both the Shinnecock identity and African-American identity. And I think that comes out in his work around civil rights. And this collection is the largest book production of its kind to feature indigenous photographers from both South America and North America. And the authors, Brian Adams and Sarah Stack, have been working on putting this collection together since 2020. And Herb's work is prominently featured. One of the photographs is about to go to a gallery in Santa Fe, the Obscura Gallery. So we're here to collect his signature on those prints. And the hope is that this will go into schools and go into public narratives as a way to think about how Indigenous people can tell their own stories, because so many of the images have been created in ways that depict a very traditional settler-colonial relationship. And so it's just a beautiful collection of 250 photos, portraits, family photos, ethnographies, fine art pieces. And Herb has five images in there, along with his nephew. And it was just a great honor to write the introduction to Herb's work and to think about how much he put into his collection. So much of his work was about trying to tell that counter-narrative of the families and relationships and commitments at the heart of the struggle beyond the, well, he said he didn't want to take pictures of dogs and the clan and the blood. He wanted to tell human relations. And so within the larger collection, his work really sits at a very particular intersection because of those shared identities.
Yeah, it's just an honor to be in such a book, because it's rare. And
well, I really appreciate you taking time to sit here and to share. I really appreciate that.
In Light and Shadow, A Photographic History from Indigenous America is a Nautilus Book Award winner and can be purchased through most major book retailers.
You're listening to a pre-recorded episode of Another View. Please hold your calls and enjoy the show.
Eric Taylor has traveled around the world sharing his amazing skills as a violinist. Whether he's performing at a local celebration or on national television, he leaves his audiences both captivated and longing for more as he strums out gospel, jazz, or even classical tunes. And what makes this phenomenal performer even more amazing is he's never had a single violin lesson.
I have to admit that this is a gift. This is something that I've been gifted to do, and my allegiance will always be to God. I can play all styles of music, but my roots will always be in gospel. Total Praise, that song has been the anthem, and it just kind of wraps up everything in a great big bow. I have to give him total praise for how far he's brought me through.
To watch and listen as Eric Taylor plays can be transformative, his energy high, his moves athletic, as he allows the music to transport him.
It's hard to describe. You become one with the music, you become one with the instrument, and it takes over. When you allow yourself to be free and just to play, don't worry about anybody. Just play the music as it comes and is given to you. And I think that's what happens. And so I'm not even aware of what's all going on until someone may show me a tape or something. And I'm like, oh, I didn't even know that happened. It encaptures me. And I just flow with whatever's happening.
Surprisingly, Eric's journey didn't begin when he was little, or even in middle school.
I started playing violin around the age of 14. A choir director at my church was also a music instructor, and she had a vision of me playing, and she said, I want you to try this. And she gave me my first violin, And that's where it began. I'm an only child, and so it gave me a bit of something to try. It was a bit of a challenge, and I wanted to see what I could do with it. And also, I was introduced to the Virginia Symphony Orchestra, and I was inspired by watching just all of them play together in a collective sound. And it just encouraged me that, you know what, I can do this too. I played cello, actually, in high school. It was the only instrument left. So I started with cello, and I was introduced to violin later. After high school, I went on to college, Virginia Commonwealth University, and I pursued music as a minor, and I wanted to be a journalist as my major, but it just got to be where the violin and the music just took over, and I began to travel. So I actually ended up pursuing the violin as my career choice. Around the age of 22 or 23, I began to be passionate about the music, and I felt connected to it in such a way. And I really felt like this is no longer a challenge. This is actually fun. My favorite jazz song, I like Misty. But there are so many that I also love in the jazz genre.
And I get misty just holding your hand.
I saw how it brought happiness to my audience and the stories and the inspiration of their children and old alike. It just made me feel like this is really my purpose. I love to feel that they are feeling what I'm feeling and that the message that I'm trying to portray to them is being received. It's really beyond what I can describe in words. I love people and I'm passionate about what I do. I'm very happy and satisfied with myself and my life direction. And I hope that I'm inspiring someone. I'm hoping that I bring a smile to someone's face and that I encourage them to utilize their own gifts. We all have something that's given to us, that's unique to us, that we can do and only we can do like we do it. It has been so incredible, the places that I've been able to go. I've most recently played in Dubai. I toured in Germany and France, Trinidad, Tobago, London, the Bahamas, all across the country. And I have an invitation to go to Australia. And so that will be my next abroad trip.
The father of two daughters and two sons, Eric and his wife Angela always make sure they take time for family and each other.
My wife Angela, who's a great support, my number one cheerleader. She's always with me as much as she can be. I've got a grandson, so gonna spend some time with him. I like my parents and caring for them. Just kind of finding things to do that unwind from the music genre for balance. Traveling, vacationing, just to do that.
And even though he's never had a lesson, Eric says he never stops learning.
With my latest trip to Dubai, I dressed in their traditional garments to play, and I wasn't sure exactly what I should play. But I'm glad I had the experience. It went super well, and I was invited to go back in April. I like that. That's what keeps it fun and interesting. Next time I'll learn some of their language and begin to interact with some of the locals that way. The right moments are always great. They will literally bring tears to my eyes when you see something and it just went so right. The wrong things are cool too, because they help me to grow. They help me to remain centered, and it keeps me humble to say it's not gonna be perfect all the time. I'm not a technical violinist. I play from heart and feel. And so things are gonna happen, and it's not what happens to you, but how you respond to what happens to you. And that's a lifelong journey.
That's going to do it for us today. Thank you so much for tuning in. Next week on Another View, it's all about Juneteenth. So be sure to register to be a part of our live audience. You can register to save your spot at whro.org/events. Our theme music is an original composition created especially for Another View by Jay Sennett. Lisa Godley is our show producer, and Jordan Christie is our audio engineer. I'm Barbara Ham Lee. Enjoy your weekend, and let's get together again next Thursday at noon for Another View.
Support comes from Hampton Roads Community Foundation, carrying out your charitable wishes forever. Whether it's helping shelter animals, feeding the homeless, enhancing the arts, or supporting students. Learn more at leaveabequest.org.